Okay, so in the text, in the three principles of the path, we were talking about renunciation or the determination to be free from cyclic existence. The second one, the loving, compassionate thought of bodhicitta, the altruistic intention. And third, the wisdom realizing emptiness. And so then in talking about the first one, the determination to be free, we got as far as verse 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay? And so verse 4, the first sentence, by contemplating the leisure and endowments, which I also translate as freedoms and fortunes, so difficult to find, and the fleeting nature of your life, reverse the clinging to this life. So that's talking about how to develop the determination to be free, the first step being giving up clinging to simply the happiness of this life, because that's a huge obstacle towards getting anywhere spiritually when we're just totally buzzing around our present life's happiness. And then the second sentence, by repeatedly contemplating the infallible effects of karma and the miseries of cyclic existence, reverse the clinging to future lives. So that's talking about how to stop craving for good rebirths in cyclic existence and generate the wish to be free altogether. So we've been still on the first sentence, you know, about talking about how to give up the obsession with the attractions and the pleasures of this life, because that becomes a huge obstacle for spiritual practice, because it consumes so much time chasing and running around looking for pleasure wherever we can get it. And because in the course of looking for pleasure, we create a lot of negative actions, which leave negative karmic imprints on our mind, which bring about suffering results. So as we chase around running, looking for our own pleasure, we actually create a lot of suffering, causes for suffering for ourselves. Okay, because in seeking just the happiness of this life, I mean, that's what motivates people to kill, to steal, to have unwise sexual behavior, to lie, to use their speech in disharmonious ways, to gossip, to use harsh words, you know, the whole thing. Okay, it all comes. The motivation behind it is my happiness now. Yeah, and that's the basic motivation with which we live our life at present, my happiness now. And if it can't be right now, this very moment, okay, well, at least 5 minutes from now, and the longest I'll wait is my old age. You know, so we'll make preparation for old age, even though we're not sure we're even going to live that long. But we're, you know, just totally involved with the happiness of this life. We don't think beyond this life. We're like, what happens after we die? You know, and yeah, what happens after we die? Where do we get reborn? We don't think about a higher purpose to life because we just run around chasing, you know, all of our own little ego thrills. Basically, I mean, we cloud it in all sorts of other stuff, but that's kind of what it boils down to, at least when I look at my own mind. Maybe you people are better off than I am, but that's a description of me. So we were talking about, you know, the eight worldly concerns as being the epitome of happiness for this life. So these eight being in four pairs. First, attachment to money and possessions and displeasure at not getting them or losing them. You know, and the second being delighted and happy when we're praised and approved of, and being miserable when people criticize us or blame us or disapprove of us. Third, you know, wanting a good reputation and a good image in front of other people, and you know, not wanting a negative one. And then fourth, wanting sense pleasure, to see good things, hear nice sounds, smell, taste, touch, you know, all these things. And not wanting bad sensual experiences. And so, you know, just looking for those, seeking to get those, the four of those pairs and avoid the other four, is kind of what seeking the happiness of just this life boils down to. And, you know, that's how most of us live our lives. We create a lot of negative actions in the process of it and make a lot of misery for ourselves and others. So as antidotes to that, you know, as ways to oppose that and generate the determination to be free, first we thought about our leisure and endowments, our freedom, I translated as freedoms and fortunes of a precious human life. So I'm just reviewing now what we've talked about the last couple of weeks. So in particular, you know, with our precious human life, learning to recognize its qualities, then seeing its purpose and meaning, and then seeing how rare and difficult it is to attain. And then the second part of that, okay, as this sentence, the first sentence in the fourth verse says, okay, the first part was contemplating the leisures and endowments of our precious human life, and the second part is contemplating the fleeting nature of our life. So in the long run, that's the meditation on impermanence and death. So that's what I want to talk about in this talk, you know, impermanence and death, and how we use that to bolster our spiritual practice. And this is a very, very important topic, because they say if you don't remember impermanence and death in the morning, you waste the morning. If you don't remember it at noontime, you waste the afternoon. If you don't remember it in the evening, then you waste the evening. Okay? So it's a very important topic. It's the first thing the Buddha taught after his enlightenment. You know, when he taught the first the Four Noble Truths, impermanence and death is the first topic under that. And it's the last topic he taught too, you know, and he illustrated that by his parinirvana, by he also passing away and giving up this body. Okay, now death and impermanence is something that general people in society do not like to think about and do not like to talk about. And we have this view that if we think about death, it might happen, and if we don't think and talk about it, it might not happen. Right? So we go through life not thinking and talking about it, not making any preparation for it, but it's the one thing that's certain to happen. Okay. And I remember as a little kid, you know, there was on the highway near where we lived, you know, there was a Forest Lawn Memorial Park, you know, they couldn't call it a cemetery because that speaks of death too much, so it was a memorial park. And I remember as a little kid, you know, driving past that and asking my mom and dad, you know, well, what happens there, you know, and they, well, that's where dead people are. Well, what's death? People go to sleep for a long time. And I got the distinct image, you know, feeling I was not supposed to ask any more questions. You know, we don't talk about death because it's too scary and it's too mysterious, it's too unknown, so we'll just pretend it doesn't exist. And yet, our life is framed by our own mortality, isn't it? You know, we have a calendar full of activities. You know, Thursday I have to do this, and Friday I do that, and Saturday I do this, and I have so many things in my life, and I'm so stressed out, and so many things to do. But if you look at it, we don't have to do any of the things, those things in our calendar. None of them are things we have to do. The only thing we have to do is to die. That's the only thing that's definite about our life, is that one day it ends. Everything else that we say we have to do, that's not correct. We don't have to do it. We choose to do it. And I think this is really important, because in our lives so often, oh, I'm sorry I can't practice the Dharma, I have to go to my child's recital. Oh, I'm sorry I can't go to this retreat, I have to work overtime. We don't have to do any of those things. I think we should be honest and say, I'm choosing to go to my child's recital. I'm choosing to work overtime. You know, I'm choosing to spend my money on this and not on that. You know, I think that's much more honest than saying I have to, which is not really true. Okay, so the meditation on impermanence and death has many advantages, and if we do it, and it has many disadvantages if we don't do it. So let me talk a little bit about those, because I think it's important to understand why we do this meditation. Okay, so there's six disadvantages if we don't remember impermanence and death. First one is that we don't remember to practice the Dharma or to be mindful of it. We just space out, get totally involved in our lives. Second is, if we do remember the Dharma, we won't practice and we'll procrastinate. So that's what I call the manana mentality. You know, I'll do my spiritual practice manana. Today I'm too busy. Okay, so it gets manana'd all the way until we die and no practice gets done. The third disadvantage is that even if we do practice, we won't do so purely. You know, so we might attempt to practice, but because we don't remember impermanence and death, our mind still has a motivation for the pleasures of this life. Okay, so I'll go to Dharma class if it's fun, if it's interesting, if I can be close to the teacher and get some emotional strokes, if I can get some prestige by going, if I can be famous by learning the Dharma. Okay, so our practice becomes impure if we don't really purify our motivation through remembering impermanence and death. The fourth disadvantage is that we won't practice earnestly at all times. In other words, our practice will lack intensity. We might practice with a little good motivation, but then we kind of lose it after a while, and our practice isn't intense. And we see this all the time. I mean, this is the story of our practice, isn't it? We get really into it, and then after a while, kind of becomes old hat and boring, and we do it as a routine, but it isn't vital in our minds anymore. Okay, the fifth disadvantage is that we create a lot of negative karma, which will prevent us from gaining liberation. Okay, so like I was saying, when we're just seeking the happiness of this life, because we don't think about mortality and karma and what comes after that, then we don't take care with our actions. We do all sorts of unethical actions to get the pleasures of this life or to retaliate when somebody harms us in this life. And so we create a lot of negative karma, which brings suffering. And the sixth disadvantage is that we will die with regret. Okay, why do we die with regret? Because we've wasted our life. We haven't used it to transform our mind, and instead we've just accumulated a lot of negative karmic imprint. And so when the time of death comes, we die with regret. You know, which I think, you know, must be the most awful way to die. I mean, ever since I've been a kid, I've always had the feeling, you know, I don't want to die with regret. Because, I mean, dying with physical pain is one thing. Yeah, but dying and looking back with on our life and thinking, I wasted my time, or I used my energy in harmful ways, I harmed other people and I didn't repair that, I think that would be so painful. You know, worse than physical pain is to die with that kind of regret. Okay, so that all comes from not thinking about mortality. And because by not thinking about mortality, we just get involved in all of our selfish worldly concerns. Okay, the advantages, there's six benefits of remembering death and impermanence. First one is that we'll act meaningful and we'll want to practice the Dharma. Okay, so when we remember death, it makes us think, what are my priorities in life? And that gets us to make our life meaningful and to practice it. Second is our positive actions will be powerful and effective because they won't be contaminated by ulterior motivations for this life. So we'll create very powerful positive actions of real benefit to ourselves and others. Third is remembering impermanence and death is important at the beginning of our practice. In other words, it propels us on the path, because when we think about our mortality, it makes us do this reflection on our whole life. And I've lived up until now, and you know, when I die, what am I going to have to take with me? What's been the meaning of my life? So that reflection impels us to make our life meaningful. It gets us going on the path. And then fourth, it's important in the middle of the practice, because remembering impermanence and death helps us persevere as we're practicing. So, you know, sometimes we go through different difficulties and hardships on the path. You know, everything's not always pleasant. We practice the Dharma and still people criticize us and blame us and talk behind our back and, you know, betray our trust and all sorts of things. But, and so those times, you know, we might want to give up our spiritual pursuits because we're in misery. But if we remember impermanence and death and the purpose of our life, then we don't give up in the middle of the practice, and we realize that these hardships are actually things we can endure, that they're not going to overcome us. Fifth is that remembering impermanence and death is important at the end of the practice because it keeps us focused on beneficial goals. Okay? So at the end, towards the end of the practice, when we really have wisdom and compassion and skill, by remembering, you know, the changeable nature of things and our own mortality, then we feel really energized to make use of the skills that we have to benefit all beings. And then sixth benefit is that we die with a happy mind. Yeah? And so they say that, you know, if we remember impermanence and death while we're alive and then we practice well, when we die, you know, we don't die with regret, and we even die with happiness. And they say, especially for the great practitioners when they die, that death for them is so much fun. It's like going on a picnic, you know, which seems, you know, unbelievable to us. But, I mean, I've seen people have quite amazing deaths. I'll just tell you one story. I have a lot of stories about death. But this is one that really made a very strong imprint on me. When I lived in India, the Tushita Retreat Center where I lived was up on a hill. Just underneath the retreat center, there was a row of mud and brick houses, about six rooms, actually just single rooms of mud and brick, where there were some Tibetan monks who lived there. And there was one very old monk who hobbled around with a cane, and one day, it seems like he fell over right outside of his hut. The other monks who lived in the other rooms were away doing a puja, a religious service somewhere else. They didn't see him, and one Western woman who was walking up the hill to the Western Center, Tushita, saw him there. And she ran up to us and she said, "Hey, you know, there's this monk and he's fallen down and he can't get up, and is, you know, does anybody have medical skills?" So there were a few of us there. There was one person, one woman from Australia who was a nurse. And so she and I and one Tibetan nun went down there, and this poor monk was lying sprawled out. And we put him on the bed in his room, and he started hemorrhaging, okay? Meanwhile, his Tibetan friends had come back, the monks had come back, and they just were very calm about the whole thing. They put a plastic sheet underneath him because he was hemorrhaging so much, and they just said, "Okay, we'll go do our spiritual practice. It looks like he's dying, you know, we'll start doing the prayers and things for him." But the Westerners, you know, up at the retreat center, one man heard about this and said, "Oh, you know, I mean, we can't let him die. Death is important." So he got in the jeep. He took the jeep, ran all the way down the hill because the hospital was quite a ways away. Got the doctor, you know, at the hospital, took the jeep all the way up the hill. And this is like a narrow one-lane road, you know, with a cliff on one side. So he got all the way up the hill. The doctor got out, looked at the monk who was hemorrhaging, and said, "He's dying. I can't do anything." You know, so it was really interesting for me because, you know, the monks just knew it and accepted it right away. The Westerners, even though they were Dharma practitioners, couldn't accept it and, you know, had to do all this stuff. Anyway, so as he was hemorrhaging and this incredible stuff was coming out of him, they would pull the plastic sheet out and bring it to me, and my job was to take it and put it over the side of the mountain. Great job, huh? So, and then they put, they'd alternated two plastic sheets to keep underneath him. And then the monks finally said, "Okay, our preparations for the pujas are ready." Because this monk had a particular meditation deity that he had practiced most of his life, and so the other monks were going to do the puja, the religious service of that particular Buddha figure. So they called me and maybe one or two other people there into the room, and we started doing that practice. And the nurse and the Tibetan nun stayed to help this monk who was dying. So they told us afterwards that, once everybody left, he said to them, please sit me up in meditation position. I want to die in meditation position. So since he couldn't move, they moved his body and got him upright. But he was so weak from all the hemorrhaging that he couldn't sit upright. So then he said, well, just lie me down and put me in the physical position, the posture of my meditation deity. So they did that, but his body was too weak to sustain that. So then he told them, this guy is hemorrhaging, and he's giving them directions on what to do, okay? And then he said, okay, just put me on my right side, in the lion position. This is the position that the Buddha lay in when he was passing away, with your right hand under your right cheek and your legs extended and your left hand on your thigh. So they put him like that, and he said, okay, just let me die now. And he's completely calm. He wasn't freaked out at all, totally calm. The nurse from Australia, she wasn't a Buddhist. She had just been visiting the center. She came out afterwards. She said, I've never seen anything like this, But he was like completely calm. So meanwhile, the rest of us were doing this puja, kind of one or two rooms down. And it took us several hours, maybe 3 or 4 hours to do it. And when we were done, we came out, and one of the monks, who was at the puja, who was a friend of this monk who was dying, so again, their friend is dying, they're completely calm, no big crisis, no big problem. His name was Geshe Jenpa Wangdu, remember him quite well. He went into the room where this other monk had died, and because there's certain signs in the body that, that indicate whether somebody is going to have a good rebirth or not a good rebirth, whether the consciousness has left properly or not. And Geshe Lhasa came out, and he had this big smile on his face. His friend just died. He comes up out smiling, and he's chattering in Tibetan, saying that, he died so well, and he was in the right position. You could tell he was meditating, and, he let his consciousness go to the Pure Land. And, he came out, and he was so happy. And so, this made such an impression on me of a practitioner, because this was just an ordinary monk, one of these, old monks around Dharamsala who nobody notices, but just an ordinary practitioner who did really serious practice and then died so well, and his death was so inspiring for, those of us who were there. It was so amazing. So, it made me think this is the benefit of meditating on impermanence and death, is that it makes you practice. And when you practice, then, you die very, very peacefully. Okay, so then the question is, well, how do we remember impermanence and death? And here, there's two ways to do it. One way is called the 9-point death meditation, and the second meditation is imagining our own death. So these are two different meditations, and I'll talk about both of them, because this stuff is really, really valuable for us in our practice. Now, I need to preface this by saying that the purpose of thinking about death is not to get morbid and depressed. Okay, we can do that all by ourselves. We don't need to come to Dharma class to learn how to get morbid and depressed. That's not the purpose. And the purpose isn't to get a kind of fear that's panicky, like, I'm going to die, because we can do that all by ourselves too. Okay, the purpose of thinking about impermanence and death is so that we can prepare for it. So that at the time of death it isn't frightening, so that at the time of death we're ready to die and we're very peaceful. And we prepare for death by practicing the Dharma, by transforming our mind, by giving up our ignorance, anger, selfishness, clinging, attachment, pride, jealousy, purifying our negative actions, you know, creating negative actions. This is how we prepare for death. So this is what this meditation is designed to inspire in us. And it does a really good job. You know, if we meditate well on impermanence and death, I know for myself, my mind gets very calm, you know, very, very calm, very peaceful. Can you imagine that? You know, meditating on death makes your mind so calm and peaceful. But again, I remember when I was living in India, one of my teachers was giving us some private teachings in his room, going through one text by Aryadeva, Aryadeva's 400, and that text has a whole chapter about impermanence and death. So for like a week or two, every afternoon, he's teaching us impermanence and death, you know? And then every evening, I go home and I meditate on what he taught us. Those 2 weeks when I was really practicing this meditation intensely, my mind was so peaceful. You know, my neighbor used to play her radio loud. It used to disturb me. It didn't disturb me during that time. I wasn't upset with her for playing her radio loud. I didn't care because her playing her radio loud was like inconsequential in the big scope of things. You know, somebody said something that was hurtful to me. I didn't care because in the big scope of things, when you think about life and death and what's important when you die, somebody, you know, criticizing me or offending me, who cares? You know, it's no big deal. Or, you know, things not happening the way I want them to happen, you know. Considering I'm going to die, this is no big thing, you know. So, you know, just thinking about this really helped me put things in perspective and helped me let go of a lot of things that normally my mind would make a big fuss about. So that's why I say that this meditation can make your mind just very calm and peaceful, you know, really focused and centered. Okay. So let's look at the 9-point death meditation and how to do it. Okay, the 9 points are divided into 3 subgroups. So each subgroup has a heading, and under it, 3 points, and then a conclusion at the end of that thing. Okay, so that's for each of these 3 subgroups. So the first subgroup is death is definite. The second, you know, subgroup is the time of death is indefinite. And the third subgroup is at the time of death, only Dharma is important. Okay? So let's go back and look at those 3 subgroups and look at the 3 points under each one and the conclusion of each one. Okay? So death is definite. Okay? The first point under that is that everybody dies. Okay, this is something I think we all know already, don't we? Everybody dies. But we know it up here in our head, and we haven't really actualized that. So it's very helpful, just in this first point, you know, that, you know, everybody dies and nothing can prevent our death. I think here, what I do with this point is I start thinking about people I know and remembering that they die. I mean, if you want, you can start with historical figures. I mean, because look, even all the great religious leaders all died. I mean, the Buddha died, Jesus died, Moses died, Muhammad died. Even great religious leaders die. You know, nothing prevents death. Also, you know, the people we know. I mean, our grandparents, our parents maybe have died. If those people haven't died yet, they will die. And I think it's very helpful to think about the people that we are very attached to and remember that they're going to die, or even visualize them as a corpse, because it's a reality. You know, they are going to die, and, you know, to remember that, it helps us to prepare for that. And so along that line, to remember also that we're going to die, and one day we're going to be a corpse lying out and people will come and look at us. You know, if we had a, you know, a regular death, not in an accident, they'll come and look at us and go, you know, too bad. And, you know, if they embalm us, oh, she looks so peaceful. You know, Or maybe, you know, maybe people will be crying around, or who knows what they'll be doing, but one day we'll be laid out, you know, unless we're in too bad of an accident and they don't want to show the body to anybody. But, you know, just to think, everybody's going to die, whether we know them or don't know them. Yeah? And go person by person and think about that and really let that sink in. Yeah? And that's very powerful for our mind. The second point under nothing can prevent death and everybody dies is that our lifespan can't be extended when it's time to die. Okay? So, you know, our lifespan is getting shorter moment by moment. When it runs out, there's nothing you can do. Okay. Now, it's true that sometimes people are sick and we may do certain spiritual practices to remove karmic obstacles that may bring on an untimely death. So that can, you know, remove an obstacle to somebody's living out their whole lifespan. But, you know, our bodies aren't immortal and, you know, most of us are not going to live past 100. Yeah? And definitely, I mean, how old is the oldest known human being? I don't even know.
A little over 100, 110.
Or something, yeah. So figure 120?
I think there's somebody living now.
Yeah. So, you know, definitely, okay, most of us here are over 30, well, almost. we're 25, okay. So figure in another 100 years, for sure, we'll all be dead. Everybody sitting here in this room won't be here any longer. You know, this room may still be here, you know, but none of us are going to be alive on this planet, and, you know, other people are going to be using this room. So there's nothing we can do to extend the lifespan past a certain point because the body, by its very nature, dies. It decays and dies. You know, from the time it's born, it's in the process of decaying and dying. And there's nothing we can do that can prevent its demise. There's even stories that at the time of the Buddha, was it Mogliana who was the one who was very skilled in magical powers? I think it was him. Anyway, he could do all these fancy magical powers and go to another universe or things like that. But even if you do that, you still can't avoid death. Okay, so even if you have clairvoyant powers, even if you can fly in the sky, you know, even all sorts of special things as people can do, it doesn't prevent death. Okay? And every moment that's passing, we're getting closer to death. Okay? And that's really something to think about, you know, every day when we wake up in the morning, to think I'm a day closer to death than I was yesterday. The next day, I'm a day closer to death than I was yesterday. Geshe Nawandarge, one of my teachers, used to say that he couldn't figure out why we Westerners celebrated birthdays. He said, you're only celebrating that you're 1 year closer to death. What's the point? No. But it's true when we think about it, you know? The lifespan is running out. It's, you know, if we think of our lifespan like an hourglass and the sand's going down there, there's only so much sand in the upper part of the hourglass. And there's, you know, one day it's going to run out and there's no way you can stop it from going down. That's just the nature of things. Okay? So there's no way to extend our lifespan. And then the third point is that, you know, under death is definite, is that it's definite even to happen even if we haven't had the time to practice the Dharma. Yeah? Because sometimes, you know, in our mind we think, well, I won't die until after I practice the Dharma. And since I'm too busy today, I'll do it later, so I'll die later. Okay? But that's not true. So they tell the story in the scriptures the person who lived to be about 60. And on his deathbed, he looked back and he said, the first 20 years of my life, I was too busy playing and getting an education to practice. So those 20 years were wasted. The second 20 years of my life, I was too busy having a career and a family, so no Dharma practice got done then. That was wasted. The third 20 years of my life, my faculties were declining and my body was in pain and I couldn't remember things so well. So that time got wasted. And now I'm dying. And it's true, you know, we die whether we've practiced or not. So, you know, again, it's helpful to think of, you know, think of our own life specifically. No. And when, you know, we're going to die, and what are we going to have to take with us when we die? You know, and have we practiced? Are we ready to die? No. And this actually leads into the second subheading, which is the time of death is indefinite. No. Because we all feel, we might get to the point where we say, okay, I'm going to die, I accept that, death is definite. But the but we feel, you know, I'm not going to die today, okay? I'm going to die later. And I even, one time, I was giving a teaching like this, and I came to this point, you know, about the time of death is indefinite, and one man raised his hand, and he said, well, the insurance company says that the average length for women of life is da-da-da, and for men is da-da-da. So, you know, we have another few years left. And I said, oh, you know? So we always have this feeling, you know, death isn't going to happen today. And even the people, you know, who die today, you know, what is it, May 23rd, 2002, even the people who die today, when they woke up this morning, did not have that thought, today I could die. Isn't it? You know, the people, let's say people in the hospital, people who woke up in the hospital this morning, you know, some of them are going to be dead by the end of the day, aren't they? They have terminal illnesses in the hospital or in old age homes. I don't know if any of them thought today could be the day I die. They probably think, I'm sick, it's terminal, but I'm not going to die today. I'll die later, you know. Even though it's terminal, I still have some time. I'm not going to die today. And then how many people die in accidents? You know, those are people who are terminally ill and they don't think I'm going to die today. But how many people are healthy and then die in accidents and they also didn't think I'm going to die today? No? And here, I think, I mean, I'm sure we all have stories to tell and experiences, you know, about people we know who have died very suddenly without any warning at all. When I was first, you know, learning this, one of my friends told me this story about her sister. And her sister was in her mid-20s, and she loved belly dancing. And this was several years ago before they had CDs. So her sister would practice belly dancing to a record, you know. So one evening, her sister and her husband were at home. Her husband was in one room reading or something. And her sister was, you know, practicing her belly dancing with a record. And the husband all of a sudden heard the record just get to the end and keep, you know, how the record just keeps scratching at the end. And he didn't understand what the matter was because his wife always, you know, would play it again and keep practicing. And he went in there and she was dead on the floor. Woman in her mid-20s. I don't know what it was, you know, if it was a heart attack or an aneurysm, a brain aneurysm or what it was. I don't remember now. But just like that, you know, somebody who was totally healthy. And, you know, people dying in car accidents, you know, get up in the morning, oh, I have so many things to do today, I have to go so many places, get in the car, you know, and don't even make it a mile from their own house, and they're dead. Now, look at 9/11. Isn't 9/11 the perfect example of the time of death is indefinite? You know, and the interviews they did with people after that, you know, people telling about their lives and you know, all their hopes for their families and what they were going to do. And, you know, it was a normal, regular work day. But they didn't make it, you know, past 10 o'clock. They were all dead by then. So, you know, for us to have this feeling that we're going to live forever, or even the feeling that we're not going to die today, it's totally unrealistic. It's totally beyond the bounds of realistic thinking, isn't it? You know? Now we can say, well, look how many days of my life I've had so far, and I haven't died yet, so isn't it correct to assume that today also I won't die? But, you know, the time of death is indefinite. Death is definite, you know. So definitely one day is going to come where we're not going to, you know, get past that day. And so to really be mindful of that, you know, every day that this day could be the day we die, and ask ourselves, am I ready to transition into my next life today? Yeah. If death all of a sudden happened today, am I ready to let go? Or do I have things that are left undone, things left unsaid, that need to really be taken care of before I die? And if we do, to be on top of our lives and do those things, in case today is the day that we die. So the first point under this one, that the time of death is uncertain, is that in general there's no certainty of lifespan in our world. Okay? And that people die in the middle of doing all sorts of different things. So there is no certainty of lifespan. You know, some people might live to be 100, some people till 70, some to 43, some to 37, some to 25, you know. But people die in their teens, people die as children, people die even before they get out of the womb. So there's absolutely, you know, no guarantee about how long our lifespan is going to be, because we die at all sorts of different times. And we're always in the middle of doing something when we die. Yeah. So we might have this kind of notion that, you know, okay, death is definite, but I'll organize my life and take care of everything I have to take care of, and when everything's taken care of, then I'll die. Okay? Because, you know, we always like to organize everything and plan it out. But, you know, there's no fixed lifespan. And we're always going to be in the middle of doing something. When are we ever, have we ever finished all of our worldly work? Yeah? I mean, you even the rare days when you clear off all your email, your inbox, 5 minutes later, there's more email, you know. There's no end to it. No matter what work we're doing, okay, there's always worldly work, there's always more worldly work to do. Okay, if you work in a business, there's always another day of, you know, manufacturing things, or another day of serving your clients, or another day of fixing things. We never get all these things done. So if we have the mind that says, I will practice Dharma later when all my worldly work is accomplished, we're never going to get to that point where we have time to practice the Dharma, because there's always going to be more stuff to do. And I think that this is one of the crux, the key points, you know, that people don't see why they don't have time for Dharma practice. It's because they keep thinking, I'll finish all these worldly things first, you know, then I'll practice the Dharma, because then I'll have more time. But, you know, you never get to that point where it's all taken care of. There's always something more. And people are always in the middle of something. I mean, people go out to dinner, they have a heart attack in the middle of dinner, they're in the middle of eating dinner, and they die. Yeah? I mean, I've certainly heard stories about that happening to people. You know, people, I heard a story in China that there were some people who got married. And, you know, in China you always put off the firecrackers as celebration. This young couple, they were crossing under a doorway, they put off the firecrackers, and the firecrackers fell down on them and killed them as they were going off. On your wedding day, you get killed. In the wedding celebration, you get killed. You know? It's amazing, isn't it? So, you know, we're always in the middle of doing something, going somewhere, finishing a project, in the middle of a conversation. Even you're lying in a hospital bed, you're in the middle of one breath, and you die. You're in the middle of a sentence. You're in the middle of a visit with a relative, and you die. You know? Accidents, you're in the middle of a conversation. So, you know, the time of death is indefinite, and, you know, it happens at all different sorts of times. The second point under that is that there are more opportunities of dying and less of remaining alive. In other words, our body is very fragile, and it's very easy to die. And if you think about it, it's true. I mean, we feel like, oh, you know, my body's so strong. Yeah, you know, this kind of macho feeling, you know, I have such a strong body. Then you get, you know, one tiny virus that you can't even see with the eyes and it kills you. Huh? One tiny virus. One tiny little piece of metal goes in the wrong place in our body. Like that, we're dead. You know? One teeny, teeny blood clot gets lodged in the brain, gets lodged in an artery of the heart, we're gone. You know, so we feel that our body's so strong, but you know, I mean, our skin gets cut so easily. You know, just even a piece of paper cuts our skin. No, our bones break very easily. All of our organs are very fragile. They're easily damaged. You know, but it's very, very easy to die. Our body is not that strong. Okay, and that leads into the third point, which is our body is extremely fragile. Okay, so the second one is it's very, you know, there's more chances of dying and less of remaining alive. And third is that our body's very fragile. And it's true, it is, you know. And if we look, you know, why does it say that there's more chances of dying and less of remaining alive? Well, we have to exert so much effort to stay alive. You know, to die takes absolutely no effort. You know, to die, all we have to do is lie down, not drink, not eat. We'll die. Not take care of our body, we'll die. Requires absolutely no effort for our body to die. To stay alive, we have to grow food, we have to cook food, we have to eat food, we have to get clothes to protect our body, we have to get medicine to keep the body healthy, we have to build houses to take care of the body. You know, we spend so much time and energy in our life taking care of this body. Why? Because if we didn't, the body by itself automatically would die. And think about it a little bit, you know, how much time and energy we have to put in to taking care of our body and keeping it alive. So it is very easy to die, and our body is fragile. Okay? So, let's review here. Under the first point, you know, that the death is definite, we said that nothing can prevent us from dying, that everybody dies. And second, that our lifespan won't be extended, you know, at the time of death, and that it's ending moment by moment. And third is that we can die without practicing Dharma. The conclusion from those first three points under death is definite is the conclusion we draw from contemplating that. Okay. Much practice.
What's a Dharma?
Dharma means the Buddha's teachings, the path to enlightenment. Okay? Much practice. Practice Dharma means transform our mind. You know, let go of the selfishness, the anger, the ignorance, these kinds of things. You know, develop our inner qualities. Okay? Then the second main heading, you know, that the time of death is indefinite. Okay, the three points under that, that you know, we're always going to be in the middle of doing something when we die, that there's no certainty of lifespan. Second, that there's more opportunity to die and than to stay alive, because we have to exert so much effort to stay alive. And third, that our body is very fragile, even small viruses and pieces of things, you know, you eat the wrong food and you can be dead. So our body's very fragile. The conclusion from thinking about those three points is that I must practice Dharma now. Okay? So the first conclusion was I must practice the Dharma. The second one is I must do it now. Why now? Because the time of death is indefinite and I could die very soon and I can't afford to have this manana mentality because I may not live that long. Okay? Now we get into the third subheading, which is nothing can help us at the time of death except the Dharma. Okay, that's the third broad heading. And the first point under that is that our money and wealth is of no help at the time we die. Yeah. Doesn't matter if you're rich or you're poor, when you die, you die. Doesn't matter if you're, you know, lying in a gutter or in a, you know, an expensive bed with golden sheets. You know, none of our wealth can prevent us from dying. I had a real interesting situation with this. I was called into Bill Gates's best friend was dying. He was, you know, somebody at Microsoft who Gates was very close to. And he had lymphoma. And Gates loaned John his jet to fly him all over the country to go to specialists. You know, he went to the best doctors. Money wasn't an issue because Microsoft was doing very well. You know, he had the jet to fly in. You know, all the wealth couldn't prevent death. Yeah, didn't do anything to prevent death. And at the time of death, none of the wealth was important. And this man was actually very smart and he understood that. You know, in spite of his wealth, he understood that the wealth wasn't important. I was quite impressed with the way he died. Okay? So if wealth isn't important at the time we die, why do we spend our whole life worrying about it and working so hard to get it and being so stingy and not wanting to share it? At the time we die, you know, all of our money and wealth stays here, doesn't go on to our next life with us. And yet look how much negative karma we create trying to get it and protect it. Is it worth it? Now, and how much worry and anxiety we have over that.
So if you practice the Buddha teaching, So this means you don't have to be afraid of dying, is that what that means?
Yep, that's what it means. Be nice to not be afraid of dying, wouldn't it?
And what else?
Okay, well, I'm getting there. Okay? Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so our wealth is, you know, of no importance when we die. So why do we worry and fret about it so much when we're alive? Especially it all stays here, and we die, and our relatives, you know, all quarrel over who gets it. Isn't that a tragedy, you know, when relatives, siblings, you know, quarrel over their parents' belonging and the wealth? I think that's so sad. No? And the parents work so hard to get it, and then all that happens is that their children, who they love, create negative karma fighting over it. Tragedy. Okay, second is that our friends and relatives aren't of any help to us at the time we die either, because they can all be gathered around us, but none of them can make us, prevent us from dying. No? We can have our spiritual teacher there. We can have all of our spiritual friends there. We can have everybody praying for us, but that can't prevent us from dying. No? And at the time we die, it's said that they don't help us in the sense they can't prevent us from dying, and they can't necessarily make our mind into a positive state when we die. We have to make our mind into a positive state. They might be able to help. They remind us of the path, remind us of the teachings, give us some advice, or do some chanting that reminds us. But we are the ones that have to put our mind into a good mental state when we die. Nobody else can do that. And when we die, our friends and relatives stay here. We go on alone. None of them accompany us into death and help us out. You know, it's an adventure, it's a solo adventure, solo flight, okay? So given that, what's the use of being so attached to other people? I mean, this is a real important question. Given that our friends and relatives, you know, they can't purify our negative karma, they can't come with us when we die, they can't prevent our death. Yeah. Why are we so attached to them? What's the use of being attached? What's the use of the mind that wants to be liked and popular and loved when none of that can prevent us from dying, and none of that can make us have a good rebirth, and none of that can get us closer to enlightenment? You know, this way of thinking, this meditation, hits on some of our real core attachments and really makes us call those things into question. Third point under this is that at the time of death, even our body is of absolutely no help. In fact, our body is the thing that betrays us when we die. So this body that we've been with since day one, that's always come around with us, you know, at the time we die, it stays here, and our mind, our consciousness, goes off into another life. So, you know, given that our body stays here, what use is it, you know, worrying so much about how we look? You know, because we're always worrying about how we look, and does my hair look nice, you know, my makeup, and, you know, am I showing my figure off, and the guys are worried, you know, am I muscles strong, am I athletic, you know, are all the women going to be attracted to me, you know, or we're always worried about our body, and, you know, keeping it well, keeping it attractive, and yet, you know, our body just totally, you know, betrays us when we die. It stays here and we go on. You know, and even if they embalm us and we look so beautiful when we're dead, so what? You know, do you want to, if you had clairvoyant powers from your future life, do you want to look back at your previous corpse and say, you know, are you going to get any status out of, oh, my previous corpse was so beautiful, everybody's praising how nice I looked, how nice my corpse looked, you know? I mean, my friend's mom was dying of cancer, and after she died, you know, I mean, she looked horrible when she was dying. After they died, they embalmed her, and at the funeral, people were saying, oh, she looks so beautiful now. Who cares, you know? Yeah? And who cares what, you know, of our prestige during our life and our power during our life? Because when we die, all that prestige and power and fame is gone. I mean, you look, this century, some of the most powerful people, okay, Stalin, Hitler, you know, Truman, Roosevelt, yeah, Mao Zedong, Lee Kuan Yew, you know, whoever it is, you know, all these very powerful people, what happens after they die? Can their power do anything after they die? You know, they may be very powerful and famous. You know, maybe Marilyn Monroe while you're alive, you know, be very famous, having everybody ogle over you. But when you die, you know, none of that comes with you. It's just all past tense. So what use is it worrying so much about if we're famous, if other people appreciate us, if we've, you know, attained the status and the rank that we aspire for, you know? Because even we attain whatever status and rank, we might not aspire to be politicians or movie stars, but in our own little lives, we have our own little things that we're attached to and things we want to be famous for. Yeah, you want to be the best golfer in, you know, Jefferson County. Yeah, whatever it is, you know, we get attached to all these things. What use is that if when we die, you know, none of it comes with? No. And our picture may stay behind, you know, oh, they're, you know, prom queen or, you know, golf champion or the person who grows the nicest bonsai trees or, you know, whatever your thing is. And there might be pictures of you and, you know, might even be a wax museum and a hall of fame. But, you know, when we leave this life, who cares, you know? We're not even going to be around to appreciate it. And yet, so if it's none of it is important in the long haul, why do we worry about it so much while we're alive? You know, and get so obsessed and so worried and so paranoid and so depressed and, you know, all this kind of stuff. It's just, it's not worth it. Yeah? So what we conclude from meditating on this is that we need to practice purely. Okay, so we not only need to practice the Dharma, we not only need to practice it now, but we need to practice it purely. In other words, we need to work to transform our mind, you know, to really make our mind happy through spiritual practice, because that's the real kind of happiness. And we need to practice the methods to do that in a very pure way without looking for any kind of ego boost along the way. Okay, and this is especially said because it's so easy when we're practicing a spiritual path to look for ego perks, you know, kind of, I want to be known as a good Dharma teacher. I want to be known as a, you know, a fantastic meditator. I want to be known as, you know, a scholar. I want to be known as somebody who's very devout. No. If I have a good reputation as a good spiritual practitioner, people will support me and, you know, they'll give me offerings and they'll honor and respect me and I'll get to walk in the front of the line and they'll write newspaper articles about me and, you know. And it's like, you know, this kind of thought very easily can come into our mind when we're trying to do a spiritual path. But that, it pollutes our motivation. Okay, so practicing the Dharma purely means to go ahead with our spiritual practice without looking for these ego perks along the way, and, you know, and just to really, you know, try and overcome our self-centeredness and develop impartial love and compassion, you know, try and let go of this, see through the ignorance that covers our mind and see the emptiness of the self and phenomena. No, that's what we need to do, and to really practice this in a pure way as much as we can. And so you see, when we meditate on death, then the motivation for spiritual practice comes from inside. Okay? Then we don't need discipline, people to discipline us to practice. You know, often in a monastery, we have to have a daily schedule of what time to meditate, what time to chant, and, you know, do these things. Because, you know, sometimes we lack our own internal discipline. When we have an understanding of death and impermanence, we are disciplined. You know, we have our own internal discipline because our priorities are real clear, you know, and we know what's important in life. We know what's not important in life. Nobody needs to tell us to, you know, go and meditate. Nobody needs to tell us to go and do our purification and to confess when we've, you know, made mistakes. Nobody needs to tell us to make offerings and create good karma. Nobody needs to tell us to be kind because we have our own internal motivation because we've meditated on impermanence and death. So then, you know, spiritual practice becomes so easy. You know, it becomes a breeze. You wake up in the morning and it's like, I'm alive. I'm so glad for being alive. And even if I die today, you know, because time of death is indefinite, even if I die today, however long I have to live today, I'm so happy for it. I appreciate it because I can really practice and make my life highly meaningful, you know, even through very simple actions in our daily life that we do with a positive motivation. We give our life meaning. Okay? So this is the value of doing this meditation on impermanence and death. It's so incredibly important. You know, and it really, it gives us so much positive energy and really, to me, this meditation is one of the best things to do to remove stress. You know, doesn't that seem funny that you meditate on death to relieve stress? But when you think about it, it makes perfect sense, because what do we get stressed about? I get stressed because, you know, I don't have enough money to buy the thing I want, or because I, you know, overextended my credit card. I get stressed because I have so many things to do and everybody's breathing down my back to get them done. I get stressed because, you know, I did my best on a job and somebody criticized me, you know, and didn't appreciate what I did. You know, when we think about these kinds of things in light of what's important at the time we die, none of these things are important. So then we let go of them. Then there's no stress in the mind. You know, it's incredible how peaceful the mind gets when we think about death and really set our priorities. You know, best stress reliever, isn't it? Yeah. It's fantastic, you know. So that's why we need to really put some effort into this meditation. So when we do this meditation, the way to do it is to go, you know, have this outline with the three major points, the three sub-points under each one, and the conclusion of each of the major points, and you go through and you think about each point and make examples in your own mind and relate it to your own life and think about that point in relationship to your own life. You know, and then make sure that you come to the conclusions, those three main conclusions after each point, and come to those, and then really let your mind, you know, stay as single-pointedly as you can on those conclusions and let that really sink into your heart. Now, it has a tremendous transformative effect. So I talked quite long this time, but... Yeah. Do you have any questions?
Yeah. I was thinking that if somebody did know when their death was going to happen, you know, if you give them 6 months to live or something, would you do things differently? You know, I've sort of thought about that, or there is a book out, 1 year to live, when you're really supposed to imagine that at the end of the year you're going to die.
Yes.
And I'm sure all of this would be helpful, but would you really, you know, stop your daily activities and just focus on this completely?
Well, okay, so, you know, if you knew when your time of death would be, would you alter your life? Well, first of all, none of us really know when our time of death is going to be. But, I mean, even the doctors say you have 6 months. The doctors are guessing. They have absolutely no idea. You could have 6 days or 6 years, you know. But the point is, you know, when we do this meditation, we may see that some things we do in our life we just really want to stop because they're just not worthwhile. Mm-hmm. Then there are other things that we need to do to keep our body alive and to keep our life going so we can practice. So we do these, but when we have an awareness of impermanence and death, we do them with the motivation of bodhicitta instead of with the motivation of our own selfish pleasure. Okay? So, you know, we still need to eat. Yeah, to keep our body alive, okay? So understanding that we're going to die doesn't mean we don't take care of our body. We do take care of our body. We still need to eat. But now instead of eating because, you know, I want to eat because it tastes so good and, you know, and it'll make me look beautiful and strong and, you know, all this stuff, we eat instead like the verse that we chanted before we ate lunch today. You know, we do it to sustain our body. You know, in order to support the brahmacharya. The brahmacharya means the pure life, the life of practicing the Dharma. So we eat, but with a different motivation. Instead of one of attachment, we do it with a motivation to sustain the body so that we can practice for the benefit of ourselves and others. Yeah? You still clean your house. You can still go to work, but everything gets, the motivation for doing all these things becomes different. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And then some things we decide just to leave behind altogether because, you know, they're just not important to us.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about, like, last night when I was driving, you know, some people drive crazy, mm-hmm. and so I caught, you know, I get scared, I get fear because they, you know, cut me off and, you know, I would worry that I'll get in an accident and die. Mm-hmm. So whenever I encounter instances like that or I experience fear at all, I always try and relate it back to self-grasping, mm-hmm. So that I kind of keep it all straight in my mind. So how do you then, I mean, like, you know, it's said that biological organisms, it's like sort of hardwiring you to perpetuate your life.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I you know, if you've realized emptiness, you would never have any fear of dying.
Mm-hmm.
So you are able to somehow transcend the biological urge, you know, or is what is called the biologic urge simply the self-grasping that's been burned into our mind streams?
Okay. Thank you. Okay, I think the biological urge, I think a lot of that has to do with the self-grasping, you know, that we're so attached to our body and we don't want to let go of, you know, my body. I think that's one of the things. And also this whole image, this attachment to the body, and it's also ego identification. This is me. I don't want to give up being me. Who am I going to be if I'm not me? And if I don't have this body, then really who am I going to be? So I think a lot of that is ego grasping.
Because that was occurring to me last night when I was driving.
Yeah.
Because my heart was calming down after some crazy person nearly, you know, ran me off the road.
Yeah.
I kind of started wondering, well, what, you know, how much is ignorance and how much is just simply just this?
Yeah.
You know, the fact that I wound up with this.
Right. Well, I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, maybe some of that happens as a biological thing, but the mind doesn't get afraid. That might happen also, too. Mm-hmm. You know? I mean, I'm trying to think if an arhat, you know, were threatened by somebody. I don't know. I mean, we'd have to ask an arhat. Yeah. But, you know, maybe the body still has a reaction of, you know, an adrenaline so that he can escape. But the mind itself isn't fearful.
Mm-hmm. So how can you help yourself not to be afraid of dying?
Mm. Okay, so how can you help yourself not to be afraid of dying?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think as much as possible during our life to live with a kind heart and to not harm others, okay? Because that way we create a lot of positive karma and we abandon negative karma. And then at the time we die, you know, if we take refuge in the Buddha Dharma Sangha, if we generate our kind heart and a wish, you know, for compassion, then that makes our mind very peaceful at the time we die. And if we can have a peaceful mind when we die, because we're thinking of Buddha Dharma and Sangha, or because we have love in our heart, or because our mind, we generate the wisdom, understanding, emptiness. If we can have that kind of mind when we're dying, then it becomes much easier just to let go. And when we're not grasping onto the life, then there's no fear. You know, then we die, and it's just very peaceful. Hmm? And it can even be happy.
Thank you.